Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the session on Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia. I'm Steve Treon, and I'll be taking the next hour and a half to talk to you a little bit about the advances in both the biology and therapy of this disease. And before getting started, I wanted to take a moment to thank the Lymphoma Research Foundation for making this opportunity possible. We've had the privilege of working with the LRF on a number of different collaborative projects, and I'm extremely grateful for not only hosting this session, but also the National Forum, which I had the privilege of attending both in New York as well as in San Francisco, where similar large crowds had come together. And I think very excitingly today, I've been told that the Waldenstrom's session is one of the largest sessions here. Now, I think that's more tribute to the fact that Waldenstrom's patients tend to be very inquisitive and very curious and contribute tremendously to these discussions. Just a few weeks ago, Chris Patterson, who's also joining us here and who had organized the International Summit, yes? I think many of you know Chris, who ended up organizing the fourth International Summit on Waldenstrom's, which was hosted in Orlando. It attracted close to 400 patients and caregivers and faculty, and it was really a phenomenal exchange. So even though this is not going to be this is not the summit today, I hope in the next hour and a half at least we'll give you some of the highlights of what's been going on in this disease. When I was first recruited to Waldenstrom's by patients back in 1999, it was an opportunity to be exposed for the first time to Waldenstrom's, but it was also an embarrassing moment because so little was known about this disease, and I tried in the 20 minutes that I was given to give a progress report, and reality was there wasn't very much progress happening. And just a year later, when all the international experts had gathered in Washington, D.C., at what we now retrospectively call the first international workshop on Waldenstrom's, there were 19 of us experts who had come in from all over the world at the invitation of the National Institute of Health to help talk about this disease and to come up with ideas and strategies. And it was a meeting that was very sobering because, as you can see, what we actually came up with, despite the fact that Jan Waldenstrom described this disease 60 years earlier, was that we all agreed on the things that we didn't know, as opposed to the other way around. And we had no definition of the disease, so the pathologist couldn't really sit down and give you, a sense of what was Waldenstrom's. There were no treatment criteria, and we had the extremes. In one part of the country, the same patient would have been told watch and wait. And at the other, extreme, the patient could have been told if they had gone into another, office or clinic that they needed to be treated with chemotherapy and then transplanted. Now just think about that extreme, watch and wait, off to transplant, double transplant, in fact. There were very few published trials. There were no treatment guidelines. There were no response criteria, so we didn't even have a uniform way of saying whether a patient had responded and to compare one trial to the other. How do I know what therapy is the best therapy to go on when I don't know if the criteria that tell me that one, in one case there were so many people who responded really matches up to the other trial. And most importantly, and perhaps the biggest lament, was that there were no basic science initiatives. There was no one really trying to study this disease to understand what made it tick. And I'm going to tell you something. Even though we can look back now in the last 20 years and say real advances have been made in cancer, they've only really occurred because of our first understanding what the biology of the disease is, and then, the treatments came to follow. And so clearly there were no basic science initiatives. Now, to take credit for, what has happened in the last, 10 years in particular, has been really bringing together a global community around this disease. And this first happened in Athens in 2002, when the second international workshop happened. This is when Really, we started seeing experts coming together and focusing their efforts on the disease. And then by Paris, you can see that the numbers kept increasing. We had a little setback in June of 2007, as you can see. You might ask what happened. What happened was, you know, the 130 degree weather, you know, finally gave way. And unfortunately, the conference hall lost its air conditioning. And 130 degrees, you know, doesn't keep people very happy very long. And needless to say, people scattered, but there were a few people left behind. And as you can see, rather than waiting 2 years, because I mean, remember the first one was in 2000, then 2002, 2004, we had a little gap here. We immediately, you know, 1 year later, put it back together again. And here we were now in the Nobel Prize Hall in Stockholm, where we met in 2008. And most excitingly, you know, we concluded our 2010 meeting in October, this time in Venice, with over 100 speakers. If you can think about the fact that we went from, you know, from just knowing so little about this disease to having over 100 people come and present in, you know, in the 3.5 days, you know, to come and talk about their research in this meeting. It's a long way that we've come. The next one actually will be happening in 2012 in Newport, Rhode Island. And, you know, now we've actually had to extend the days of the meeting just to be able to accommodate what will be continued growth in the number of investigators in this disease. So I was asked as I came in the door, why are we at a lymphoma meeting? Isn't this Waldenstrom's? Well, it is Waldenstrom's, but the underlying pathological diagnosis is really a lymphoma. So if you have Waldenstrom's, you have lymphoma. And the kind of lymphoma that you have is called lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma. And there are very strict criteria that we and others have helped develop with the World Health Organization that help define what lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma is. Now, there are different kinds of lymphoplasmacytic lymphomas based on what kind of protein they secrete. For Waldenstrom's patients, it's IgM, independent of how much IgM, you know, is in the blood. But there are IgG and IgA and sometimes lymphoplasmacytic lymphomas that don't make any protein at all. But they're really in the minority. They're less than 5%, whereas 95% of lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma is, in fact, Waldenstrom's. So the vast majority of them make the IgM protein. Now, one of the big problems that we faced early on was that everybody, you know, as is tradition usually in medicine, we always like to put cutoffs, that if you're not at this cutoff, you don't have a problem. And yet that was very hard to do with Waldenstrom's because, you know, in the old days, you didn't have Waldenstrom's unless your IgM was 3,000 and above. And for many of us, we came to the, you know, reality very quickly that that number was quite artificial and completely out of context. And this is actually from a paper that I published 2 years ago in the journal Blood, where we plotted 400 untreated patients with Waldenstrom's that we had seen. We plotted their IgM versus their bone marrow. And you can see there's no relationship at all. You can have patients who have virtually no disease. In fact, there's one individual here, this little dot right here, took us 4 bone marrow biopsies to prove that he had Waldenstrom's, and even at that, he had less than 0.5% involvement in his bone marrow, but required treatment because his IgM was over 10,000 and he was symptomatic. Unfortunately, we can't give chemotherapy unless we have a pathological diagnosis, right? That, hence why for 4 bone marrow biopsies. Now, did he care? Not really. This is a guy who did 4 tours of duty in Vietnam and was ready to take on any challenge. But it helped us get him treatment. On the other hand, look at the extreme. You got people over here that have almost 100% of their bone marrow replaced with Waldenstrom cells that make virtually no IgM. And so sitting next to each other, as I sometimes see Waldenstrom's patients comparing each other's disease by saying, well, you know, I have an IgM of 5,000. The other one's going, well, I have 10,000. It doesn't necessarily mean that the underlying burden of disease, you know, is more just because you have a higher IgM. So that's important to recognize because, you know, the underlying disease can produce different amounts of IgM. And it can have different consequences. You can have people with very little disease needing therapy, and you can have people over here who have a lot of disease, but not necessarily meet criteria for treatment. Now, this disease is interesting. Even though it's a lymphoma, it's very rare, as you're going to, perhaps if you have the chance to meet other lymphoma patients here today, you know, where their disease is involves more lymph nodes and spleen enlargement, that rarely occurs in Waldenstrom's. It's really a minority of patients that have enlarged livers or spleens. Most of the disease sits in the bone marrow. And as the disease expands, it causes the hematocrit to go down, the platelet count to go down, the white blood count to go down. But a lot of times, patients need therapy not because these Waldenstrom cells are involving more and more the bone marrow. It's because of the IgM that's being made. Now, if you make too much IgM, you can get into trouble because you can end up with what we call hyperviscosity syndrome. And what happens is as the IgM load goes up, it makes the blood flow sluggish. And if the blood flow becomes sluggish, then blood vessels, particularly the little blood vessels, the capillaries, can sometimes begin to break apart, and you can end up with nosebleeds, and that's what this fancy word epistaxis means, headaches, and sometimes impairment of vision because the little blood vessels can break in the retina and cause some fogging of the vision. And this is many times how patients get discovered that they have the Waldenstrom's disease. The other problem is that the IgM can sometimes become what we call an autoantibody. It starts turning on the patient themselves, and it starts attacking vital structures, the most common of which is actually the nerves, particularly the peripheral nerves. And the patients can end up with sensory neuropathies, usually numbness, tingling, first the feet, almost always first the feet, and then it starts crawling up the legs and then skips and starts involving the fingertips. And I'll show you some data on that momentarily. The other thing that it can sometimes also cause that's very problematic, particularly for those of us who are cursed to live here in the colder parts of the country, is what we call cryoglobulins or cryoglobulinemia. Under very cold conditions, sometimes the IgM can precipitate. And it's much like putting too much sugar or salt in water. You start seeing it fall out of solution. The same thing can happen with IgM. Under cold conditions, it can fall out of solution and block the little blood vessels, particularly in the coldest parts of our body, which tend to be the fingers, the toes, the nose, as well as the ears. And I'm going to show you an example of that in just a second. And then lastly, another interesting phenomenon sometimes that can occur and be very problematic for patients is what we call cold agglutinemia. And what happens there is much under the same circumstances, under cold conditions, the IgM can then bind to red blood cells and cause them to burst, and the patient can become anemic. And we see sometimes the extremes of patients in the summer having a much higher hematocrit than the winter. And, you know, some of our advice has been to just go someplace warm for the winter. And it has worked for some people. Now, let me give you some, show you at least with hyperviscosity what can happen. This is actually very nice. I have not been able to come up with as nice of a slide as my wonderful friend and colleague Marvin Stone from Baylor in Texas has come up with. So I borrow this all the time to show you. But this is somebody who's got hyperviscosity. You see the blood vessels are plump, but what you see here is sausages, sausaging. You, perhaps some of you have heard this term. And what happens is these blood vessels have very small little muscles that regulate the flow. And when they become distended, they look like, you know, sausages. The other problem is that when these, when the pressure builds up, usually here in the periphery, you start seeing breakage of these blood vessels leading to the hemorrhages and the occlusion of the of sight. Now, this is somebody who has very bad cryoglobulins. It's a patient that we cared for at the Brigham. And this individual, too, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the IgM, colder parts of the body precipitating, causing the blood flow to not get to the tissues. And, you know, you see that the extremities turn purple. So did the patient's ear and nose as well. And what we did for this patient is we put him inside the ICU. We turned up the thermostat all the way to over 100 degrees, which only that cubicle could tolerate. Of course, all our house staff and nurses were all passing out in there. But the patient was really appreciating all this. And you know, we saw him change colors, you know. And shortly thereafter, we started plasmapheresis, and the cryoglobulins all cleared away. And this actually now is memorialized in the Williams textbook, which is the textbook for hematologists. So this is now an instructive figure to doctors to teach them about cryoglobulins. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the genetics of this disease, which are fascinating. You know, this is a disease that has a very strong familial background, but it also does some very interesting things from an ethnic point of view. Now, if this was as you go around and talk to other people perhaps today, you'll see that maybe CLL, the people who have, you know, CLL disease, may also have some familiarity. But Waldenstrom's by far does. And these numbers actually are, I think, even an underestimation because we just published an update of this study. We have now almost 1,000 people, 1,000 patients on this updated study. But suffice to say that when you look at first and second degree relatives, and first degree means directly related, second means it could be your grandparents or your aunt or uncle, have a first degree relative or second degree relative who have either Waldenstrom's or a closely related B cell disorder. So it could be another lymphoma, it could be CLL, it could be a myeloma, but you see this running in families. Now, this is an older graph which showed about 20% of all patients having a relative with one of these diseases. That number now is closer to 27%. And the reason why that number migrated up was not only because we got more people involved in the study, but as time goes on, you get the phone call. Dr. Treon, I just wanted to let you know my brother just got diagnosed with Waldenstrom's. And that's one of the things that having a center that's constantly tracking patients over time, and so many of you who have been our patients over the years have given us permission to follow you longitudinally. We now have close to 1,400 patients that we follow longitudinally. And what we're learning is, you know, that this familiarity is quite strong. And you will see patients over time come in and declare the fact that other relatives or other members of their family, you know, have also developed either Waldenstrom's or another kind of disease. Now, in contrast to myeloma, which we're often compared to, in myeloma, there's a 2-to-1 ratio of African Americans to Caucasians. There's a disproportionality. In Waldenstrom's, you almost never see anybody of African descent. On the other hand, what you see is people who particularly can identify as being individuals of Ashkenazi or Eastern European Jewish descent. That's about 20% of all patients based on the study the updated study that we're now reporting. So there is a very strong genetic basis for this disease. Now, to help us sort this apart, the International Waldenstrom's Macroglobulinemia Foundation gave us a grant to study the familiarity of this disease. And these numbers also have to be updated. There's close to 1,000 individuals now on that study. Close to 250 families have been enrolled. And we've been following these people very closely. We obtain their medical and familial history from the get-go. And then we collect all kinds of DNA samples, blood samples, medical history, and follow them over time. And this is what we've come to understand. There are really three patterns to Waldenstrom's. Sporadic, meaning only one patient in a family can be identified. Familial, where only Waldenstrom's can be identified. So this is actually a family not too far from here. Grandfather had Waldenstrom's, father had Waldenstrom's, and both of his children have Waldenstrom's. And then we have the so-called mixed B-cell presentation, which means one patient has Waldenstrom's, but if you look at the family, there are other kinds of lymphomas, CLL, that also are found in that family. Now, more intriguing to us has been this very large study that we just published in the journal Clinical Lymphoma. It just came out, actually, this week. And we've also been looking at other cancers that run in the patients as well as their families. And there are clear patterns there, once again. But I'm only going to show you here the data that actually pertains to other cancers within the patient that's been diagnosed with Waldenstrom's. And it actually separates out depending on whether or not that individual is from a background of being sporadic, meaning no other cases of Waldenstrom's, versus being, you know, from one of those familial groups. And what we've come to see is more prostate cancer running in the patient and more breast cancer if you're a female, about 10% actually, within the patients themselves if they come from that sporadic background. Whereas what we see, interestingly, is people that come from the familial backgrounds tend to have a higher risk of lung cancer. And so the point to this, to you as individuals, you know, to come away with is that, you know, just because you get diagnosed with Waldenstrom's doesn't mean forget about all the other, you know, routine medical care that you require, the routine cancer screening that you require. Even more so, I just want to emphasize to you, stay on top of that. And why I say that is because if you look down here at this number and forget about the familial versus sporadic breakdown, 29% of you will end up with up to 29% of you could end up with another, you know, malignancy. And there are other things here that we need to worry about. I already mentioned prostate or breast, skin cancer, both melanoma and non-melanoma. So getting your skin exams is really important, you know, to keep on top of that. Thyroid we've seen pop up, although these numbers have been relatively low. Colon cancer surprisingly didn't come up here as a main issue, But I wouldn't discourage any of you from staying on top of, you know, your colon screening as well. So, you know, don't forget your primary doctors, what really this is telling us. Stay on top of your routine cancer screening. And just remember, we're all living longer and longer these days, so we're going to be more and more prone to cancers, and we want to make sure we're there before they're there. So what have we been doing to try to sort out the cause of Waldenstrom's? Well, we've been at a couple of different ways to discern this. And I'm going to tell you, you know, for the field itself, there's been at least 10 solid years of trying to discover what causes Waldenstrom's. 10 solid years. We've employed every kind of technology out there. We've had a lot of hints. We've had a lot of suggestions based on our work. We've never had a direct hit. But that's all changing now. And I'm going to just tell you very excitingly that we're going to submit the manuscript this afternoon, which will summarize the work of our whole genome sequencing studies. This is a technology that finally we've been waiting for, which is a technology meant to allow us to interrogate every single DNA molecule in a tumor cell and to be able to look for what that one mistake is that created the tumor from the starters. And it's exciting because the technology now allows us to basically go in there, you know, take apart somebody's entire genome, and not only take apart the genome from the tumor, but go back and take perhaps normal tissue from that same individual and match it up. And that way you can come and see what exactly that one mistake was that allowed for the tumor to occur. Up to now, we haven't had that break because all of us are so different. I mean, our DNA structure is so different, one from the other. And even if you're trying to compare one to the other, you're going to see lots of differences. But when you start comparing within the patient themselves and looking and seeing what the mistake is, you can find, you know, perhaps that needle in the haystack. And we got lucky. Our first 30 patients that we sequenced, 10 of those patients we had tumor, and we had normal cells that we paired up, and bingo, all 10 of them had the same identical mistake. And so that's the most exciting part to report to you, because believe it or not, we can try to fix that mistake because it's in a pathway that's very fixable. And that's what's got us, you know, day and night now going, and we're finally there. We hope to actually get that manuscript in. We're hoping to be able to get that out very soon. And, you know, for us now, it doesn't mean this job is done, because Waldenstrom's tumor cells are very complicated too, as we've come to learn. There are other things in there that we need to understand. And still, this doesn't give us the sense of why were we predisposed to this disease to begin off with. That's still a mystery that we still have to try to solve. But the actual mistake that we think that turned that switch on, that allowed that cell to grow, I think we nailed that one this time around. So let me go on now and talk to you a little bit about, you know, the therapy of this disease. Just because you have Waldenstrom's, as I alluded to earlier, it doesn't mean you need to be treated. And so it was very important for us to be able to come up with guidelines to advise doctors when it's right to treat and when it's wrong to treat. And so these are really meant to be recommendations to physicians, but I think they've served their purpose. And Bob Kyle and Veronique LeBlanc could be given credit for having put this set of recommendations together. So if the hemoglobin is less than 10 because of the disease, some of you may follow hematocrits, that's about 30, so it's usually a 3-to-1 ratio. If the platelet count is less than 100,000, if the viscosity is high, or if the patient has significant neuropathy or cryoglobulins or cold agglutinins, and they need to be treated, then it's fair game. Otherwise, watch and wait is appropriate. You know, at the Farber, we follow about 800 patients a year who come to our Waldenstrom's clinic. 40% of those patients we don't treat. So it's a sizable number of people, and that's why, you know, when you see us kind of going through your individual cases, it's because we want to know, you know, if we need to treat from the get-go. And if we don't, then we'll want to watch you, you know, from time to time and, you know, determine ultimately if we need to treat. Now, perhaps the drug that has made the biggest difference in this disease is that of rituximab. And even though I know the Disney people are going to be after me for putting this up without a copyright, let me tell you why I did so, because it's important to tell you that Rituxan is an interesting molecule, but it's part mouse and part human. And the mouse part is actually the part that binds to the tumor cell. So Mickey's playing a very important role. And this part is called the FAB portion. Now, at the other extreme of the molecule, when this thing was engineered, you know, it was engineered so that the part that actually is meant to interact with the human immune system was human. And this was the problem in the older days when antibodies were being at least attempted to be used for treatment of diseases like Waldenstrom's, because the entire molecule was mouse. And even though the mouse part can bind to the tumor, the mouse part couldn't interact with the human immune system. And so that was really the setback that prevented this kind of therapy from working in the 70s and 80s. But in the 90s, at IDEC Pharmaceuticals, they succeeded in basically doing, you know, genetic engineering, if you will, where they were able to, you know, cut off the mouse portion and fit onto it a human, you know, region that could interact with the human immune system. And Rituxan is roughly 90% human, 10% mouse. And that poses some challenges to some individuals because many times, and I shouldn't say really many times, you know, altogether, but, you know, for many of you as patients, sometimes you have an intolerance, and I would say it's about 10% of you that will ultimately have a problem with getting Rituxan. And I want to show you at least what some of the solutions that is. That is a larger number, by the way, than if you go talk to any other lymphoma, you know, folks here today, because Waldenstrom's people tend to make more antibodies or react against this mouse portion, we feel, than other disease, you know, other related diseases might. So what has this antibody done? Well, just for those of you who want to know how Rituxan works, it, you know, the antibody comes along, it binds to the tumor, and then all these immune cells, particularly an immune cell called the natural killer cell, comes in. It has a receptor, and this receptor actually then binds on to the human part of the antibody, and then this immune cell will kill the tumor cell. That's how, this is how, you know, Rituxan works. And it's important for you to understand this because I'm going to show you in just a moment, you know, why it is that some people get a response to Rituxan and other people don't. Now, how well does it work? Well, it works very well when it works. This is actually one of the first papers on Rituxan working in Waldenstrom's. We published this back in 1999, and it was somebody that we had treated who had a lot of disease, 90% of their bone marrow impacted, had been through a lot of therapy. When we did flow cytometry, this big blotch that you see here is all Waldenstrom cells. These are all the normal cells left in the individual. And look what happened after Rituxan. They're gone. The bone marrow has been cleaned up. Only the normal cells are left behind. Now, Rituxan also has some interesting quirks in Waldenstrom's patients. Sometimes it actually stimulates, you know, the cells to make more IgM. And this we can now call the IgM flare. And it's a big problem for some patients because when they flare, you know, if their IgMs go up abruptly, they can end up with some, you know, catastrophic events. This is somebody who we were following in clinic, and this was before we recognized that this kind of flare existed. Their IgM was 7,500 before Rituxan. 4 weeks later, they got 4 weekly infusions of Rituxan. It was now 12,000, and they were in the intensive care unit with a major head bleed, fighting for their life. And that's when we began to get curious and try to understand why it is that this IgM went up so abruptly. You know, our first guess was maybe all the Waldenstrom cells kind of died altogether and released all this IgM. Well, that didn't turn out to be true because when we did the patient's bone marrow biopsy again, it hadn't changed at all. The disease hadn't changed one iota. And so that's when we began to recognize that something else is going on here. And as we followed patients more closely over time, actually, many patients ended up having this kind of flare. Now, it's important to recognize this because a lot of times when the patients flare, you'll also get the doctor calling and saying, well, my IgN is going up, you know, very rapidly. You know, do I need to now switch chemotherapy and start something else? And so it's important to know this because people can sometimes flare, but they're actually responding. You look at their bone marrow, and they've got half the disease burden that they did, even though their IgM may be twice as much. I know this is confusing, but that's why if we ask you to have another bone marrow biopsy done to help us figure out what's going on, that's really one of the reasons why we would do so. Now, you might ask, why is this happening? And we spent almost 10 years trying to understand this phenomenon. And thanks to the work that's been done by Guang Yang and our group, we finally have come to terms with this. And why it's happening is not because the Rituxan is directly stimulating the Waldenstrom cells to make more IgM. It's because it's actually, you know, interacting with other immune cells. And the way we came to this conclusion was that not only do we see people who got Rituxan have this flare, but also many times we give patients with Waldenstrom's IVIG, which is a replacement antibody because they're prone to various infections. And we saw the same flare happening. And that's when we began to say, well, maybe it's not the part of the antibody you know, the mouse part that's binding to the tumor cell that's stimulating. Maybe it's the other side interacting with receptors that in turn stimulate, you know, these cells. And so monocytes are cells that all of us have. These are scavenger cells. They go around, they're hunting down tumors, viruses, pathogens. And when you stimulate them, they make a lot of interleukin-6 that in turn causes the tumor cells to make more IgM. And so we're looking now at ways of blocking this pathway to make giving Rituxan more safer. And some of the ways we're hoping to do it is actually by directly interfering with the receptors that actually end up causing this kind of signaling to happen. Now, Rituxan by itself is a valuable therapeutic, but you know, whether you give 4-weekly infusions or 8-weekly infusions, the response rates are on the lower side. You know, many times we're asked by patients, well, why not Rituxan alone? Well, sometimes we hesitate because, you know, we're not happy with only 25% of patients responding, or if you use the extended Rituxan, 40% responding. Even more so, you hardly ever see anybody getting into a good remission, a complete remission. And so I'm going to tell you in a little bit that's very important in this disease. It's only been when we've combined Rituxan with other chemotherapeutic drugs like cyclophosphamide. And when I say cyclophosphamide, some of you have heard some of the acronyms out there, CHOP or CVP or CPR, RCD. These are, you know, various combinations of cyclophosphamide with steroids or with other chemotherapies. And with that, 70 to 80% of the patients can respond. CR rates are still pretty low, about 8 to 10%. If you use the drugs called nucleoside analogs, and some of you have heard the drug fludarabine or cladribine, you know, we're in the 70 to 90% range. Sometimes we can combine with thalidomide, about 70%. Bortezomib or Velcade, almost every drug these days has a trade name and a generic, so if you hear me use the word bortezomib, it's the drug Velcade. 70 to 90% of the patients respond, and maybe up to a quarter of the patients get a complete remission. And then lately, bendamustine has been the important new drug, 90% response rate reported. The CR rate is estimated around 30% with that combination. Let me go on a little bit here and tell you that even though we have a lot of combinations, you know, these days we have to worry also about toxicity, you know, both short-term as well as long-term. And the one drug that has perhaps given us you know, the most anxiety has been the nucleoside analogs, that being fludarabine. This is actually from a study that we published in the journal Blood in 2009. It had a pretty good follow-up, you know, just about 3.5, 4 years follow-up where we followed the patients long-term. And what we saw was that 10% of the patients converted over this time to an aggressive lymphoma called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. 7% of the patients came down with leukemia. And 5% of the patients developed some other form of cancer. And so these are numbers that actually, you know, began to sink with us because many of these patients had not been treated with another kind of chemotherapy before to say, well, maybe it was that other chemo that played some role. Some of them had only got the fludarabine and Rituxan together. And so we spent even more time trying to sort out what was going on in these patients as others did. And we've all come to the conclusion that these nucleoside analogs can put patients who have Waldenstrom at risk. You know, that transformation rate runs somewhere between 5 and 10%. And there's also a small but real incidence of leukemia, acute leukemia, that also can occur as a consequence. Now, to help get over this problem, we and others have been looking at other drugs, other drug classes. The one that we've actually spent a lot of time on are these drugs called the IMIDs. IMID stands for immunomodulatory drugs. And we got involved with these drugs because we wanted to use them as a way of stimulating the immune system to go after Rituxan-bound cells. And perhaps the one that many of you are familiar with is the drug thalidomide. This was the drug in the 60s that many of you recall, you know, got banned because it was causing, you know, limb loss in the fetuses that were being born to mothers that were on thalidomide for nausea and vomiting associated with pregnancy. And with this, there are now two other derivatives, lenalidomide as well as the drug pomalidomide. Let me tell you a little bit about these IMIDs. The problem that we face with thalidomide is neuropathy. And I know for a fact there are people in this audience that were on this trial. And we had a fair amount of patients that ended up with neuropathy because of the thalidomide. And one of the things we came to recognize very early on is if a drug can cause neuropathy, Waldenstrom's patients get it because they're at a higher risk from the get-go, whether it's thalidomide or Velcade or vincristine that we sometimes use with CHOP, we see a lot of it. Lenalidomide, on the other hand, caused another weird event, and that is that the hematocrits in these patients drop like a rock. You gave the drug, and 2 weeks later, they'd come in with, you know, 10 points less in their hematocrit. And sometimes they didn't even come into you. The emergency room would call up and say, I've got your patient here, Dr. Trion. And thankfully, those calls don't come in anymore. But it proved to us something very important, because these drugs have been deemed safe in other related cancers that they were being used in, like myeloma or other types of lymphomas. And yet, in Waldenstrom's, they cause these quirky problems. And so this is one of the reasons why I always tell people, you know, particularly physicians, just don't borrow a drug off the shelf because it works in the neighboring disease, that we really need to do trials and study them, because patients can have different side effects, you know, based on their own constitution. And so for that reason, I think doing clinical trials that are specific to Waldenstrom's patients is so, so critical. Now, these days, the trial that we're running is with the drug pomalidomide. It's a derivative also of thalidomide. It has very little neuropathy associated with it, and is not as punishing on the bone marrow as lenalidomide is. But despite that, our first patient who we put on the study had a drop in their hematocrit. We've rolled back the dose once again. And again, patients with Waldenstrom seem to be behaving differently than myeloma patients, where they've been able to give all the way up to the highest dose, you know, range with this drug. And so this study is currently ongoing. It's accruing pretty nicely. And I hope ultimately it will give us a non-chemotherapy approach to treating the disease, because these drugs are considered to be, you know, non-mutagenic and, you know, may have a very nice synergy with drugs like Rituxan. Now, the next drug class that I want to talk about are the so-called proteasome inhibitors. And the reason why I put up this big, you know, dump truck here, and some of you, I think up here in the Northeast, you've probably seen these trucks, right, going around the waste management people. So, and we know what we want to do with Waldenstrom's, right? We want to put it in a nice dump truck like this to send it off, you know. And so the proteasome is actually a wastebasket that sits in all of our cells, including the Waldenstrom cells. And every protein, you know, that regulates how a cell grows and survives ultimately goes to the wastebasket. Now, sometimes some proteins, we don't want them to go to the wastebasket. We want them to circulate and stop the tumor from growing. And it's a fine balance. But if you can poison the proteasome, and there are drugs that do that, you can actually make a difference. And Waldenstrom cells are particularly prone to poisoning because they make a lot of IgM. It's a protein. And if you poison the wastebasket, they then, you know, basically suffocate because they're making so much protein they can't regulate it anymore, because there's no place to toss it if they can't secrete it. And so these have been very effective drugs. In fact, I have to tell you, some of the best responses in any disease have come with the drug bortezomib, which again is known as Velcade. There are, however, new players in town, and I want to teach you a little bit about these new drugs, because these are going to be our new trials, and I'm really absolutely ecstatic to get these drugs opened in Waldenstrom's, because these two in particular have virtually no neuropathy associated with them. And so let's talk a little bit about bortezomib. It's been a successful drug, whether we give it as you know, a single agent, but more so if we combine it with dexamethasone and Rituxan. And it's been a successful drug whether we give it, you know, for the second line therapy or the first line therapy. So when we give it in first line, you know, we've been able to get response rates up to 95%, a quarter of the patients in a complete remission. I'm going to show you in just a moment the updated progression-free survival to show you how long these remissions can last. But the problem that we come across is neuropathy. 30% of the patients can end up with significant neuropathy. Now, the way we typically give bortezomib is twice a week for 2 weeks and then a week off. So you get treated like on a Monday, Thursday, and then you get a week off, and that's considered one cycle. But the other way you can give it is just give it weekly, maybe at a slightly higher dose. And if you give it at a slightly higher dose weekly, we see about the same range for responses, but a little bit less complete remissions, you know, about 10% of the patients. We're not sure if we're getting patients in as long remissions, but, you know, the trade-off is that we see very little neuropathy. But let me show you here what we've been able to accomplish using these drugs. This is actually just a recent update showing the combination of bortezomib, dex, and Rituxan. We call this BDR. BDR is progression-free survival now estimated at over 56 months. And these estimations, I got to tell you, are hard to pinpoint because, you know, we haven't had, you know, half the patient cohort yet relapse. And so, you know, this number could go on much, much longer. But the fact that, you know, at first glance, they're getting over 56 months of average, you know, disease control is very exciting to us. The big debate, however, these days for us is balancing risk-benefit with bortezomib-based therapy. If you give it twice a week, perhaps better, deeper responses, perhaps better progression-free survival, meaning longer disease control. Shorter response for sure, that the patients seem to go into remission faster. Sometimes that's important. If you have hyperviscosity and you want to get your IgM down, you know, this could have an important advantage. The Rituxan flare that I mentioned to you, we see less of it when we give twice a week as opposed to once a week. But the trade-off is neuropathy. Clearly, with once a week, we see very little neuropathy compared to twice a week. And so for this reason, we tend to be, you know, very ginger. We'll take our patients individually. If we need to get disease control faster because it's threatening their life, we'll go with perhaps a twice-a-week program. If we think we have a little bit more time on our side, we might go with a once-a-week program. And sometimes we'll start the patients off with twice a week, maybe for a couple of cycles, and then transition them to once a week just to help decrease the neuropathic risk. Now, as I mentioned to you, there are other drugs which are coming our way which don't have neuropathy. Those are the ones to get excited over. Carfilzomib, in particular, will be approved by the FDA, I hope, this year. The data in myeloma is absolutely fantastic. It actually targets the same, you know, proteasome, so the same wastebasket here. So there's the recycling center here. And the other drug, which is made by Millennium also makes bortezomib, actually works upstream. So the way this whole process works is, I mentioned to you earlier that proteins end up, you know, after a while going to the wastebasket to get disposed, and some of them we want to keep around. Well, the way that they get trafficked to go to the wastebasket is these little tags called ubiquitin. And if a protein is circulated long enough, they get a lot of these tags called ubiquitin, or UB, attached to them. And if you get enough of these tags, it's time to go off to the wastebasket. That's how I feel with my kids these days. I, you know, just keep feel I'm getting enough of these ubiquitin tags added to me, and at some point I'll be off to the nursing home with them. So that's how you got to think about this. Now, what you want to think about also is how do I get away from them? You know, how do I get away from these ubiquitin tags? And these drugs, like Millennium-4924, can poison the drugs, poison the enzymes that put these tags on. That actually may be an advantage to us. This is the data from the carfilzomib studies in myeloma. Roughly 10 to 12% of myeloma patients get significant neuropathy with bortezomib. With carfilzomib, it's 1%. And so this is why we're excited to bring this drug to Waldenstrom's. This is the way we're going to give this drug. We hope to have this trial open sometime this summer. But patients will basically get up to 6 cycles of carfilzomib. This is given a little differently than bortezomib. You basically get it on a Monday, Tuesday, and then you get a week off. So it's 2 days in a row for 2 weeks, and then you get a week off. With this, you'll get dexamethasone and Rituxan, and then the patients will go on and get maintenance therapy. So after you're done with the therapy, every 2 months you'll come in and just get one cycle of the carfilzomib, the dex and rituximab. And this will be for patients that have never seen either rituximab or a proteasome inhibitor previously. Millennium 4924, also very exciting. In Waldenstrom's, it kills their cells very nicely, as we showed at the American Society of Clinical Oncology in the study that we presented last year. And this study has also been green-lighted. The protocol's been written and submitted. And in this case, the patients will get just the 4924 drug with dexamethasone. This is actually given much like bortezomib on a Monday, Thursday, and then a week off, you know, schedule. And patients can get up to 6 cycles and then go on into a maintenance program. And this actually will be open to everyone who, you know, has had their disease come back. So it's a study open for relapsed refractory patients, independent of what they saw previously for therapy. Now, some of you may recognize this picture. And this is actually the Berlin Wall going up. And very little, if anything, good came out of the Cold War, as many of you can recognize, except for one thing. And that's the drug bendamustine. And that was a drug which, at the height of Cold War, was developed by the East Germans because, quite frankly, they couldn't compete and buy Western medicines. It was way too expensive. And so they put a lot of their factories to use to come up with drugs. And one of the drugs that actually, you know, got vetted out as being very successful once the reunification happened of the Germanies was the drug bendamustine. And it's an interesting drug, and I want you to know a lot about this drug because it's turning out to be also a very important and pivotal drug in the treatment of Waldenstrom's. It's a drug that actually has a little bit of cyclophosphamide. So if you've gotten CHOP or CPR or CVP or any of those combinations, you know, this drug mimics a little bit that cyclophosphamide ring. But it also has a little bit of the nucleoside analog built into it. And so what we call it is a bifunctional molecule. Even though this is the oldest new drug, this drug was invented 50 years ago, we still have a lot to learn about it. And the one thing that we still have to learn a lot about is long-term toxicity. There have been some studies now published with 3-year follow-ups, but that may be still too early, which is one of the reasons why, somebody said yes, which is one of the reasons why we still have a little bit of anxiety, you know, in making this a routine recommendation for everybody. But the data is absolutely fantastic with it. This is actually from the German group, the Still group, that published a study with over 500 lymphoma patients, but they included 40 Waldenstrom's patients that were randomized between getting CHOP Rituxan and bendamustine Rituxan. And look at the difference here. At 4 years, 80% of the patients who got this as upfront therapy were still in a remission, whereas only about 15% who got the CHOP R. And our data, too, at the Dana-Farber, in patients that we've treated with bendamustine in relapsed refractory disease is also quite impressive. Most of these patients were patients that received a lot of therapy. Most of them were refractory. Refractory means that you gave the therapy and it didn't work, and you've got a very, you've got a sick population of patients that aren't responding to therapy, and you've got to move them on to another drug. And this is usually a very hard nut to crack. When somebody doesn't respond to therapy, that's usually a bad omen. The average IgM was 4,000, 60% bone marrow involvement, hematocrit 31, so you can see these are relatively sick patients. And despite that, 83% of the patients responded. Most of them actually had a very, very good response, a very deep response. Some of these patients, by the way, I just want to tell you, this was an interesting study for another reason, too, because some of these patients were allergic to Rituxan by the time they needed to be retreated. And we substituted the drug ofatumumab, which is a fully humanized CD20 binding antibody, and they tolerated it very nicely. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that drug in just a moment. Now, I alluded to you that getting a deep response is a good thing. It intuitively makes sense to you, right? If I can, you know, get into a complete remission, it should be better than, but you've got to prove these things because they're not, that's not always true. But in Waldenstrom's, it turns out to be true. This is a study that actually has now been published in the British Journal of Hematology where we treated patients that had what we call Rituxan-naive disease. These were patients that never got treated with Rituxan before, went on and got Rituxan-based therapy, and if they achieved a complete remission over 90 months of being in progression-free survival, so meaning the disease is kept in check. VGPR, now you may ask me what that means. VGPR means very good partial response. It's a category that denotes a patient who has had a 90% drop in their disease burden as measured by their IgM over 75 months. If they got a partial remission, which means at least a 50% drop, but not more than 90, 42 months. If they got a minor remission, which means a 25% drop, but no more than 50, it's 30 months. And then this category, non-responder, stable disease, 10 months. So the better the remission that a patient attains, the longer they stay in that remission. And what you want to attain, ideally for the patient, is at least a VGPR. These curves seem to be overlapping, at least at this point in time, and they separate out from the people that don't attain that VGPR. So at least a 90% drop in disease predicts for a very long, you know, progression-free survival. Now, the ability, everybody's going to say here, I want that remission, right? Okay. But your ability to achieve that, believe it or not, really rests with your own genetics. And that's something that we don't have always control over. And so let me actually show you a very provocative study that just came out from our group, where we went back once again to try to figure out why it is that some people can become VGPRs or CRs and some people can't. And it has nothing to do with the tumor, with the Waldenstrom cells, and it doesn't even have anything to do, as it turns out, with what kind of therapy you combine the Rituxan with. It has to do with your ability to engage the antibody. And once again, let's go back to those Fc receptors that we talked about. There's one receptor, which is called the Fc gamma R3a receptor, which is actually the receptor that's found on those natural killer cells. Again, these are the cells that are the hunters. They're going to come around looking for anything that's bound to Rituxan and want to, you know, bind through their receptor to the antibody and then kill the underlying malignant cell. But each one of us expresses this receptor in a different way. There's a very critical position, which is called position 158, and we can actually have one or two different combinations of, you know, what we express at this position. Some of us express this very small amino acid called valine. It's a very tiny amino acid, so the Rituxan can get into that groove, that receptor groove, into that immune cell very, very nicely. And some of us only express phenylalanine. It's a big, bulky amino acid, so it's hard to get, you know, the Rituxan antibody into that groove so that immune cell can grab onto that Rituxan molecule and then kill the tumor cell. And some of us are what we call heterozygous. We have one of each. So you can either be valine-valine, phenylalanine-phenylalanine, or one of each. And this is the relative proportion in North America of how we stack up. 10% of us only express valine. 35% are heterozygous. We have one valine, one phenylalanine, and about half of us only express phenylalanine. And there are ethnic differences. Asians tend to overexpress or be more representative in this group, whereas people of southern Mediterranean descent and African descent tend to have more valine. You know, they tend to be more homozygous for valine, meaning they have two copies. And so depending on which combination you have actually determines how good of a response you get to Rituxan. And those people, getting back to that VGPR-CR category, you know, almost 80% of those individuals expressed one valine. So the kind of polymorphism you have determines how well you're going to respond to a Rituxan-based therapy. There are actually tests to do this now. You can actually, you know, go to your doctor. There's an FDA-approved test. You want to learn more about it, it's PGX Health that actually markets it. And there's their website. And you can actually sit down with the patient in advance and tell them what their likelihood of responding to a Rituxan-based therapy is based on the kind of polymorphism that they end up expressing. And so for some of us, that's good news, and for some of us, that's bad news, depending on what kind of polymorphism you have. But, you know, help is on the way. And rather than the fact that, you know, we can't change the genomics of an individual, well, maybe we can go back and reconfigure the antibody so that it binds to people independent of what their polymorphism is. And there is now a new antibody called GA101. It's actually a antibody which has been modified. It's the Fc part of the molecule has been modified, and it's been modified in a way that's kind of interesting. Every protein usually has sugar attached to it. It's the way we all make proteins. Every one of our cells spits out a protein, but sometimes it actually puts different sugar moieties on it to make it more attractive or not to, you know, particular receptors. And if you strip away some of those sugars, it can actually allow for the antibody to bind independent of what that polymorphism is at their receptor on their immune cell. And so let me show you actually some data that's been generated by Guang Yang and our group, which we reported at the American Society of Clinical Oncology last year. These are Waldenstrom's patients who we took their tumor, and we also took their immune cells. And what we did is we sprinkled in either Rituxan or this new antibody, GA101. And let's look at the profile of somebody with FF, you know, who had the phenylalanine only, you know, presentation. Look at what Rituxan does. There is some killing, but it's relatively low compared to what GA101 can do in that same setting. And here's somebody who's VV. You see the Rituxan's doing a lot more killing, you know, when this patient here who has the good polymorphism compared to the bad polymorphism. But even here, even, you know, so GA101, you know, seems to be doing better killing. And so we're very excited about this molecule. We hope to have it in our hands. And we're also excited about it because not only does this antibody seem to overcome the polymorphism problem, but unlike Rituxan, which can't kill tumor cells by itself, this drug also has been modified in a way that it can actually, you know, trigger an apoptotic response, a cell death signal response in the Waldenstrom cells. So, and basically, we have a twofer here with this antibody that it can actually not only engage the receptors of the immune cells better, independent of the polymorphism, but also lead to more cell killing. Perhaps one of the most common questions that comes up at these forums is, maintenance therapy. You know, once you respond to a Rituxan-containing regimen, should you go on maintenance therapy or not? And this was actually a sign that was at the Brigham. It was actually because the escalator was out of order. I figured, you know, it's a photo op. And so hence I ended up with a new slide here. But let me tell you something about maintenance. This is actually data from our group that we presented recently. We hope to actually have this published very shortly as a formal study. But we looked at people who got maintenance or not in our experience. And these were all Rituxan-naive patients who, again, never got Rituxan, then went on and received a Rituxan-based therapy and either were observed or got maintenance Rituxan. And this actually shows you over time, you know, how long their remission lasted. And look down here. If the patient was untreated, 55 months that their disease was kept in check with maintenance versus 29 months if they were merely observed. Previously treated patients, it was the same, you know, kind of difference. And so at the end of the day, maintenance seems to prolong the ability of that patient to stay in remission. It tends to actually get you a better categorical response, so you move into one of those better response categories. And we see a lower IgM, a higher hematocrit in these people who have gotten maintenance. The one thing, however, that we also noticed in that study was more sinus and more bronchial infections in those people that got maintenance therapy. And this has been exactly also what we've seen in the other maintenance experiences. But the good news is that those are, you know, relatively minor complaints, you know, that can be remedied with antibiotics as opposed to more serious infections that may come about. I alluded to you that there's a new antibody in town also, which is fully humanized and that you can use as a substitute in patients who may be Rituxan allergic. Our estimation is that about 10% of all Waldenstrom's patients will become allergic to their Rituxan at some point in time. So it's important for you to know about this drug as well. This is a study from Rick Furman at Cornell. And we also, as I noted to you earlier, just recently published our data with using ofatumumab as a substitute. By itself, ofatumumab causes the same response, you know, activity as Rituxan does. And so I wouldn't run to this to use it in lieu of Rituxan. If you can tolerate Rituxan, you know, you're just as well off with Rituxan. There's no advantage. The cost may be a little bit less with Rituxan compared to ofatumumab that seems to be a little bit more expensive of a drug. You can still see flaring with ofatumumab. There's no advantage there. But if you're Rituxan, if you have a Rituxan allergy, it's a drug that you ought to consider as a substitute. And there are many individuals that we've now been able to salvage with this. Another interesting drug, another antibody drug, is alemtuzumab. I know in this audience there's at least two of you that were part of this study. This drug is also known as Campath, so you may not be familiar with it as alemtuzumab. This actually binds to CD52, whereas Rituxan and ofatumumab in GA101 bind to CD20. So this is a different target on the Waldenstrom cell. CD52 is expressed on virtually everyone's Waldenstrom cell. It's got a very high presentation. This is a study that we did in both people that had previously untreated as well as treated disease. And with this, we got a 75% response rate. We just actually submitted this study for publication, and we were just thrilled to see that there were many patients that still are in remission many years later, even people who had had very serious disease to start off with. However, the worry is that you have to be careful of infection, particularly with this virus called cytomegalovirus. And there was one death in our study attributed to this virus. And there's no way to really, prophylax safely against it, because sometimes the drug that we give to prophylax actually causes a bigger problem than the Campath drug does. And so I think it has its role in Waldenstrom's, but I would consider it only in people that have their disease come back and may need to be salvaged at some point in time. A new player in town is the drug RAD1. I'm sure many of you have heard about it. Several of you may actually be on this study. It's currently ongoing. But it's a drug that actually stops a very specific enzyme complex that's important to blocking growth factors that stimulate the Waldenstrom cells to grow and survive. And this drug, too, has caused a lot of responses in patients that have been previously treated. The length of time, though, that this actually keeps people, you know, in remission is something that's still a, you know, we're still out there. We don't really have a good number to give you because not many patients actually were stayed on the study for a very, very long period of time. With this data in mind, the FDA allowed us to go ahead and treat people as first line with RAD1. And I have to tell you, the study has accrued beautifully. There are several of you in this audience who are on this study. And there are some lessons here that I want to share with you. There's two lessons so far that we've learned. One is that many of you who, and many of the patients, I should say, including some of you who are in this audience, have had wonderful drops in your IgM. And this makes us feel really good to see these IgMs dropping from the get-go. And some, in fact, you know, we talked about VGPR estimations. Look at all the patients who had drops that you could even put in that VGPR category. The problem is that just because you quack, it doesn't mean you're a duck. And the IgMs come down, but when you go back and remarrow these patients, as we do on this study, we've seen for up to half of the patients no change in their disease burden. In fact, for some patients, the disease advanced. And it creates problems. You know, your IgM's going down, and yet my Waldenstrom's hasn't changed. In fact, it's maybe even gone up. And so that's the disconnect with this drug. It's a good drug if you want to turn off IgM. But if you want to kill Waldenstrom cells, you know, for a lot of patients, it's not quite doing it at this point in time. And so it may be actually effective in combination. My colleague Irene Gobrail is looking at this now with Velcade in combination in patients that have been previously treated. To me, it represents a very exciting study. But also, you know, this drug may still have a role. If you have hyperviscosity or if you have neuropathy or you have something that the IgM is targeting, which you want to make go away, maybe giving a drug like RAD1 will have its place. And so those are the kind of niches that we're looking to end up exploiting. And, you know, true to fact, Paracelsus, who was a great physician chemist in the Middle Ages, you know, reminded us that medicine is not only a science, it's also an art. It does not consist of compounding pills and plasters. It deals with the very processes of life, which must be understood before they may be guided. And I think this is very true of the drug RAD1, as well as other drugs in this disease. In my final slide set here, I just want to talk a little bit about neuropathy, because this is actually a very big problem that affects many patients with Waldenstrom's. Our estimations, I'll show you in a moment, are about a quarter of all patients with Waldenstrom's suffer from some form of neuropathy associated with their disease. And what happens oftentimes is that the IgM actually binds to targets on the myelin sheath that surrounds nerves. Just like you see the cables there, you know, where they're covered in, the wires are covered in rubber, this also is true to keep electrical conduction in our nerves going. But instead of rubber, you know, Mother Nature actually uses myelin and surrounds the nerves. And this is actually cross-section. These little donuts that you see are actually nerves that have been cut in cross-section and then stained with an antibody against IgM. And when you see the darker, rings here, it means that IgM is bound to the myelin sheath. Now, what happens is, once the IgM binds to that sheath, immune cells come in and start attacking the sheath because they think that it's some sort of foreign protein. There are various proteins that can actually also attack, that coalesce and start breaking down the myelin. And as a result, the cable starts getting stripped of, all this insulation. And if that happens, then all the signals go awry. And typically what you're going to see in a patient who has Waldenstrom's is they're going to come in complaining with numbness and tingling. Usually it's the toes and soles. Sometimes they'll say they're having burning or pain. And then it starts ascending. You know, they'll tell you that, when I first started with this, it was my toes, my soles, and now it's, involving my ankles, it's moving up. And somewhere between the ankles and the knees, it starts skipping then and starts involving the fingertips. And if you don't treat this, up to half the patients can become debilitated, at around 8 years' time on average. And what do we mean by debilitation? That, they have to give up driving car, they may have trouble walking because they just can't, their feet can't feel anymore, the ground that they walk on or the things that they touch. And so it is a very important problem and a very serious one. This is a study that we actually reported last year at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. 900 consecutive Waldenstrom's patients we had on this study. We excluded all the patients that had treatment and non-disease-related neuropathy, And at the end of the day, 22% of all Waldenstrom's patients had some form of disease-related neuropathy. Most of them were because of antibodies binding against the nerve sheath, some of them because of amyloid. Amyloid is a protein which can also deposit in nerves and cause also similar kinds of problems. Now, interestingly, the treatment of this turned out to be in some ways, you know, kind of interesting, because what we learned in this study is that if you use Rituxan-based therapy, you know, up to 40% of patients will say that they've had some form of improvement. Some of the other drugs, you know, that are used previously, like nucleoside analogs or drugs like clarambucil, you know, had very similar improvement responses. Clarambucil did very little. When you see combination therapies with Rituxan, you see a much higher percentage of patients. But look here at this column here, which becomes even more fascinating. The numbers aren't large, so you can't take away a lot of lessons because not a lot of people were on this outcome study. But some of the best improvements in neuropathy because of disease came with drugs that cause neuropathy. And the disconnect here is that these are drugs that are great at hammering down the IgM. The neuropathy is because of the IgM. But you risk, you know, potentially giving the patient a treatment-related neuropathy which is different than the neuropathy that they're suffering. And you know, I'm not one here to tell you today, go use these drugs if you have neuropathy, because I certainly don't want you to end up with a treatment-related neuropathy. But the good news is that drugs like carfilzomib and Millennium-4924, which represent, you know, improvements in class of these, you know, proteasome inhibitors, pomalidomide, which may be a better thalidomide with virtually no neuropathy, maybe those substitutes will turn out to be better, you know, at causing these reductions without imposing a treatment-related neuropathy. And that's where our excitement is these days, is trying to develop better ways to go about, you know, knocking down the IgM and making these neuropathies go away. What we also learned in the study is that if you have an IgM-related neuropathy, you're more likely to end up with symptomatic improvement with therapy. The earlier you catch it, the better. So we'd like to treat people with neuropathy earlier than allowing it to go on and cause more permanent destruction. We like to use combination therapy for the reasons that I just alluded to. And people who get better responses, and that's maybe where, once again, these newer combinations are getting us better responses, seem to have a better outcome than those people who have minor responses. So to summarize everything that we talked about today, familial disease, I mentioned to you, is common in Waldenstrom's. And I didn't actually show you the slide, but it can affect treatment outcome. Those patients that have familial disease tend to progress faster than those patients that have sporadic disease. There are various combinations of therapy, bendamustine, bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, thalidomide, that are active in combination with Rituxan and can be considered for the treatment of the disease. I would be very reticent on recommending nucleoside analogs like fludarabine or cladribine. These were really the mainstay of therapy in the 90s and even up to 2005. I would say this was a drug class that most people used. But now, with all these choices, we have to put this into perspective because of these long-term consequences, secondary malignancies that I talked about. Better categorical responses are associated with better progression-free survival, but you can see from the data that I presented, this is not necessarily dependent on the tumor or the therapy, but dependent on the, you know, the internal genomics of a particular patient. Lastly, RAD1 is a promising new therapy, but we have to be careful because just because, as I said to you, you know, the IgM goes down, it doesn't mean that a response is happening. And for this reason, I think we have to be very cautious with the use of that drug. And bone marrow biopsies, you know, should be really employed when we're evaluating for response with that drug. So I've said a lot today, and, you know, some of you are going to say, well, he told us about a lot of drugs and a lot of things. I just don't know, for me, you know, what the right answer is. And that's because, you know, today with choices, you've got to be really critical. You've got a lot of choices ahead of you. You want to balance short-term toxicity, short-term needs against, you know, long-term goals and long-term toxicities. And that's really what this treatment scorecard tells us. I actually came up with this after seeing my kids playing Monopoly, and I said, you know, those cards look pretty familiar. Let me see if I can actually come up with a similar, you know, version for Waldenstrom's. And so what you want to think of, you know, as a clinician now when you're seeing a patient, you know, is the patient a candidate? You noticed I didn't talk about transplant today. And that's because we rarely use it. But we always worry about the need for a patient not to be compromised so that they don't get transplanted in the future. So, you know, we will always think about the patient. Are they a potential transplant for autologous transplant? That's what ASCT stands for, autologous stem cell transplant. We don't want to use drugs that can poison the stem cells that we will need if we want to think about that person being, you know, a transplant candidate. Do you need to get an immediate response, like in somebody who has hyperviscosity or cryoglobulinemia that they're symptomatic? Then you want to use a drug like Velcade to knock that IgM down as quick as possible. Does the treatment meet the goals of therapy? With every one of these treatments, you want to address that. Is the patient's counts too low to tolerate a certain type of therapy? Are there potential side effects that can be prohibitive for the patient? If you've got a pilot, and we see actually a lot of pilots in our, for some reason, whether it's all that radiation up there, we see a lot of patients who are pilots, and they fly big planes. Well, the last thing you want is for them to have neuropathy and not feel, you know, the steering wheel, right? Or conversely, surgeons. We have a lot of surgeons too. The same thing. You know, these are people that are dependent on their hands. So maybe that's not the kind of patient you want to expose them to Velcade. Are long-term risks, you know, reasonable? You know, if you're in your 80s and you're going to be treated with a drug that may have a 5 or 10% transformation risk, that may be an acceptable risk compared to other drugs if this is a better tolerated drug. And finally, most importantly maybe, some people actually tell me, put that at the top, Trion, is this going to be covered by insurance? And it's important for these kind of recommendations because, you know what, we live maybe in a part of the country that we, you know, most of us are insured and have reasonably good insurance, but this isn't always true. You know, some parts of the country or some types of insurances don't cover a lot of these therapies. You go to Canada, you know, they always remind me, well, we don't have bendamustine up here, we don't have bortezomib up here, you know, because those things aren't even approved, let alone be covered by insurance. And so, you know, these kind of recommendations can also be different from country to country, even our neighbors, because, you know, approval differences. And so with that, I'm going to stop and thank you for your kind attention. And just to tell you, quite honestly, a lot has happened in the last 10 years. We were only given an hour and a half, and I think we still have maybe a few moments to take a few questions. But thank you for your attention. Question way back. So I was asked about the drug Calistoga 101. It's a drug that also has a very exciting potential for this disease. It ends up inhibiting a particular pathway called the PI3 kinase pathway, which some of the work that we've done, as well as others have done, show that it is a pathway that's active in Waldenstrom cells. There have been a few patients that have already received Calistoga 101 that have shown reductions in their IgM, but none of those patients have had confirmatory bone marrows to know if it's an IgM drop or a response. We have an application into the company to open up a clinical trial with Calistoga 101 in Waldenstrom's. They're going through a little bit of reorganization right now. They have a merger in progress, and that application will be considered once they get through their merger process, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to have that drug as well open. The other drug, just along the same note, is a drug called the drug class called the BTK inhibitors, or Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. These are drugs that actually block a receptor class called the BCR receptors, which are present on the surface of Waldenstrom cells, and you know maybe also another pathway to be blocked to prevent the Waldenstrom cells from growing and surviving. We have some data from our own laboratory that shows that that can, in fact, be the case. And we have actually study proposals into the two companies that make that class of drug. And again, I'm hoping sometime by the end of this year that we'll get a yay or nay from them as well. Let me assure you of one thing. We are always on the forefront trying to get new drugs for this disease. The problem is the reality of the economy has finally hit back. And a lot of these drug companies have pulled back their research budgets. And the first thing that takes a hit is the rare diseases. And so we really have to become more than ever our own advocates, you know, generating more data, you know, being more forthcoming and trying to get these drugs, you know, into the Waldenstrom's realm. But that's where we are with both the BTK inhibitors and with Cal 101. Yeah, the BTK inhibitors would include the Pharmacyclics drug. So that's the Pharmacyclics drug. And there's also a drug company here in Massachusetts called Avila that makes the same kind of drug class as well, drug inhibitors as well. Mr. Gilbert.
In addition to therapies, does the Waldenstrom itself cause neuropathy?
But that was the point I was making. So the Waldenstrom's itself does cause the neuropathy because of the IgM molecule. It can bind to nerves and cause the breakdown of the insulation. But also, the Waldenstrom cells can make amyloid protein that can layer in. And I didn't talk a lot about amyloid, but amyloid is much like chewing gum. You know, the kind of chewing gum that your kids had in their hair and that you couldn't get rid of and you decided to send it to the barber and cut it all off. Well, that's amyloid. It's a sticky protein. It gets in to organs, predominantly nerves for Waldenstrom's patients, and it layers in. And over time, it can cause neuropathy as well as other problems like heart problems and kidney problems.
If a patient develops an allergy to Rituxan, do you recommend desensitization?
So the question is, in a patient who gets an allergy to Rituxan, do we recommend desensitization? I have to tell you, we've sent quite a few people off to be desensitized and never really saw very much come out of it. So our primary focus when we see a problem with an allergy to Rituxan is we'll go back and see how we can actually suppress that allergic response. What you'll see in our practice is with everyone who gets Rituxan, the night before they get it, we always give them 10 milligrams of dexamethasone steroid. We'll also tell them to either take something like Zantac or Pepcid before they even come in for that first infusion. And then we'll give them steroids and Benadryl and Tylenol before they get the drug. And that seems to suppress things in most cases. And in some cases, you have to go back and maybe give them more steroid before they come in. Or you'll admit them to the hospital and give the Rituxan at a slower rate. Maybe you give it over 24 hours instead of giving it kind of a faster infusion that we do sometimes in the limited time we have in the clinic. And that will help make a difference for a few more patients. But there are, as I said, up to 10% of patients will have an absolute allergy, a life-threatening maybe even allergy, and we won't go back. And I actually have to say I've been relatively disappointed with desensitization options. I would rather go on and use ofatumumab. And ofatumumab has been really, I think, a godsend for those patients. Most of them tolerate it. I can't say everyone. We've had people who have also had a problem with ofatumumab, that also had a problem with Rituxan. But those are fewer in number, those kinds of patients.
I have a related question. My son was very allergic and ended up taking Rituxan in the hospital over 40 hours each time he had to take it. Does that reduce its effectiveness?
Yeah, so I wouldn't worry about the effectiveness because once the antibody gets in, it actually has a pretty good circulation time. So I think whether you get it as a bolus or you get it over a slower infusion over time, it's going to make its way to the target. And if you measure Rituxan levels in patients, I mean, most people still have measurable Rituxan even months later. So that's why I wouldn't, if you can get it in even with a 40, which is probably the longest I've ever heard, but
yeah,
if somebody's been able,
records, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's setting records. That's very impressive. But 40 hours is a long time. But I would still say that, you're fine. It's more the question of how to get it in and make sure that it gets in safely. Sir. Thankfully, it's a. So the question is, amyloid is not on the scorecard. It just means that we haven't played the next deck, so we have to expand the set here. But amyloid in of itself is a special discussion because it's thankfully a relatively rare complication of Waldenstrom's, but maybe not as rare as we first thought. One of the problems that we see is that over time, patients are more likely to declare themselves as having amyloid, and that's because it continues to layer over time. You're still making it, and it continues to layer, and then it reaches a critical threshold where the organ then becomes involved enough that it starts becoming dysfunctional. And the answer would be absolutely yes. It would make me think more about more intense therapy. the goals in those kind of patients are to get them really to a complete remission, because anything short of that is not going to stop the amyloid from being made. And depending on the degree of compromise, that's the kind of patient that we would probably end up referring to a transplant center and being, you know, more proactive and insisting on a autologous transplant for that typical type of individual. So those are not the patients that